Friday. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You've been hearing some programming changes on the Ideas Network in recent days. One of the new program additions should make Dave from Wazika pleased. He called into Mondays with Mike last month.
I wanted to recommend the show On Being with Krista Tippett. It's an excellent show that deals with philosophical, tries to clear things up, a lot of the illusions in our mind and in our society, and you could say spiritual topics and such.
And Dave, you're not alone in that request, and now On Being is coming to the Ideas Network. It debuts Sunday morning at 6. WPR host Keely Boltina talked with the host of On Being, Krista Tippett.
What is your goal with each episode that you create of On Being?
We take up the what I think of as the big questions of meaning that have been with humanity from the very beginning, and we're interested in how they are, I think, coming alive anew and finding expression in 21st century lives. And we haven't had to look very far in this last 2020 to think about that. You know, what does it mean to be human? What matters? What matters in a life? And who will we be to each other? And I think these questions are actually just rolling around, not just inside each of us, but inside all of our disciplines and professions.
But how do you manage that? I mean, these questions, they're just hard to fathom, let alone answer.
They are, but I would actually say that we're all working with them in the ordinary raw materials of our lives. And so, you know, I can interview a poet, I can interview a physicist, I can interview somebody who works with the natural world. And we're all, you know, I think this question of what it means to be human and who will we be to each other are questions we're thinking about and also thinking about in relation to how we live our lives, how we are in our families, how we create our neighborhoods, our workplaces, what we do with the rest of the years of our lives. I think we're working with them in very granular, practical ways. So I draw out people who can be really articulate about that. Because, I mean, I think part of what you're getting at is we don't have really a very robust vocabulary to talk about these things in the middle of our life together. But I feel like so many of us are longing to do that. So I draw out people who are able to do that in the context of a real life and real knowledge. And I think that that sparks this reflective piece of all of us that's there and that actually is really enjoys being sparked.
What kind of guests then do you feature on the program?
I would say I'm looking for people who are wise individuals in our world, voices of wisdom. So I think that they are people who are discovering something, seeing something, naming something that actually becomes applicable to the rest of us. You know, I in these last months, we've had on the show a psychologist, a family therapist who works with a concept called ambiguous loss. We will continue to draw out voices from many different corners on what I think of as the racial reckoning that has been with us for such a long time that has now become unseeable in this year. But not just, I would say, speaking about race, but speaking and wondering about, you know, the new kind of life together that we want to create, both what that means spiritually, but also, you know, how do we make that real in very practical terms? So all the people I interview have really worked at that inner-outer intersection.
Krista Tippett is host of On Being. The show is coming to the Ideas Network's lineup this weekend. You can hear it at 6 o'clock on Sunday morning here on the Ideas Network. Listeners to WPR now have that On Being regular time slot. One of your recent episodes deals with learning to be at peace all alone. Let's hear a little bit of it.
Strangely and interestingly, one of the great challenges of a life is to learn to be alone peaceably, at home in oneself. And now we have all at once, by way of a virus, been sent inside, physically and emotionally, even if we're not home on our own. We're forced at best to work out the difference between isolation and loneliness or an ease within the aloneness inside ourselves, solitude.
Krista, this show has such a calm tone that has to be intentional. Why do you hold on to that?
Oh, you know, you and I are both parents, I know. So I always, when people talk to me about how calm I sound, I say, you know, speak to my children. I'm a person. I don't know. I think we are. And so it's me and it's all of us at On Being. We're holding a space of seriousness, but also of reflection where there is also where joy is possible, where we are not in any way closing our eyes to what is hard and painful and uncertain about the world we inhabit and the work ahead. But we are also taking just as seriously the best capacities of our humanity and how so many people in so many ways are living that all around us at the same time. So I think we're trying to stand on a fuller ground of reality than we necessarily get when we look at the most riveting, catastrophic things that happen today in the news. You know, and I want to insist that this calmness and the work of mustering it, you know, is also part of reality.
Well, you slow things down, and that's also the format of the show. I mean, you spend a lot of time with one person.
Yeah. Yes. And in the beginning, I was told that the days of that are over, that long form is dead. But, you know, podcasting, for all its craziness, has reminded us that there is also, alongside all of how fast-moving things are and our needs to multitask and the demands on our attention, there is also a space, and we want to carve out a space for slowing down, for being reflective rather than reactive, for centering and grounding ourselves. And so, yeah, we try to draw out people who may have led very, very complicated lives and certainly have faced the complexity of life as it is, but have found a way to do that in themselves. And they become teachers for the rest of us in how to do that in our time, in our lives.
How do you want people to listen to On Being, maybe in a different way than we take in other programs?
You know, one thing that we do that many people say is surprising is I do interview people whose names are very well known. But we also try to bring forward absolutely fascinating, wise, brilliant people who are just below the radar of all that attention. So I think bringing a curiosity, I think we all know in our lives, in our communities, in our fields, we know that there are these giants who teach generations and ripple out and form so many human beings. And we try to find those people and elevate them so more people can see them. So I think be ready to be surprised, to be introduced to knowledge that you didn't know would be knowledge you could use, and to lives of dignity and beauty and grace and also good humor. It will soften the edges of perhaps the perception that that's the only thing there is to life right now.
Krista, thanks for taking time to talk with us today, and we look forward to listening to On Being.
Thank you, Keely.
That was On Being host Krista Tippett talking with WPR host Keely Baltina. On Being is now part of our weekend lineup. Join us Sunday mornings at 6 right here on the Ideas Network. For a list of program changes, go to WPR.org/fall2020. Coming up, we look at the work of the World Health Organization in the pandemic as the U.S. prepares to withdraw its membership. What do you want to know about the WHO and its role in the pandemic? Phone lines are open, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute to talk about the WHO and its work right here on the Ideas Network. Here with us for the morning show, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The State Department announced yesterday what it called next steps in the U.S. withdrawal from the World Health Organization. It includes recalling officials from headquarters, redirecting millions of dollars. We're taking a closer look at the work of the WHO and its role in this pandemic. What do you want to know about the WHO? How do you rate the agency in these unprecedented times? Join in 800-642-1234. Betsy McKay is a senior writer at the Wall Street Journal. She writes about U.S. and global public health. Betsy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate. Nice to be with you.
Well, before we get into the news this week on the U.S. withdrawal, explain how the WHO, as this international health agency, how it works, how membership works with countries and the powers it has.
Yeah, you know, it's great to have a chance to explain this because Americans generally don't know what the World Health Organization is or what it does. You know, we have our own agencies in this country that are pretty strong and powerful and play the role for us that the WHO plays for some other countries. So the WHO is a United Nations agency. It's the public health agency. It was established after World War II, partly because there were so many infectious disease problems and outbreaks around the world. There was this belief at the time, and still is, that you needed one organization to kind of coordinate, share expertise, share resources among countries to help, you know, collectively address some of these problems that affect all of us. So the WHO is made up of member states, which are countries, almost 200 of them. So almost every country in the world. And it was formed essentially by those member states, and it is governed by the member states who meet once a year and decide on rules and regulations for the WHO. The member states, countries, also fund the WHO. So it's entirely funded and governed, run by the countries that have built it, including the U.S. The U.S. is the largest donor.
President Trump has said that the WHO has a pro-China bias. What is there in that claim?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. President Trump was supportive of the WHO and of China's response early on in this pandemic. And then when the virus reached the U.S. and started spreading, he started criticizing both China and the WHO. The WHO, in a sense, has you know, become trapped in politics between the U.S. and China over this pandemic. So the accusations, the charges stem to WHO's response in the first month or so to this outbreak in China. President Trump has said that the WHO was too deferential to China, didn't push China hard enough, and was and praised China's response too effusively. We have looked back at that twice. I think everybody would agree that the director general did praise China's response probably too effusively, but it was more of a tone issue than actually what WHO was doing. In fact, you know, we found that WHO was trying pretty hard to get China to cooperate with the rest of the world and to release more key information it had about the spread of the virus or was collecting, you know, so that the WHO and the rest of the world would have an idea, you know, of what was going on. It's pretty clear that China was fairly slow to share information it was collecting. They didn't share right away that they knew this was a coronavirus. They also didn't share a lot of key epidemiological information. They may not have been collecting it all. I mean, in the heat of a new outbreak, you know, people are scrambling and may not have had every piece of data.
Every detail.
Right. But it does appear that there was that the WHO was trying pretty hard to get the information that was there. So it's a more nuanced picture than has been portrayed publicly.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Betsy McKay. She's a senior writer at the Wall Street Journal, and we're looking more closely at the work of the WHO, the role of the U.S. as it looks to withdraw from the World Health Organization. You can join in. Do you remember when the WHO declared a global public health emergency earlier this year? How did you react? What questions do you have about its work? Join in at 800-642-1234. Betsy, what does it mean for the U.S. to sever ties with the WHO and what that process will look like?
It's a pretty dramatic step. We are the largest funder of the WHO. The reason we do that is to help keep ourselves in this country secure from outbreaks and diseases overseas. And it's a humanitarian gesture. It also, the WHO plays a really critical role in global health. Not only does it lead responses to epidemics, pandemics like this, but it sets health policies and standards for the world. It leads an effort in many countries every year to pick the strains that go into our seasonal flu vaccine. I mean, without the WHO, we actually wouldn't be able to do that. So they play a critical role for us as well as other countries. So what we're doing now is saying we're not going to be members. That means the U.S. will no longer pay annual dues to the WHO. We also give a lot of so-called voluntary money that donations, essentially, that we give to the WHO for certain key health programs that the U.S. Is very involved in. For example, polio eradication. There's kind of a final push that's been going on for years to try to completely eradicate polio from the planet. To answer your question, it's a year-long process. In July, the Trump administration formally informed the WHO that the U.S. will withdraw, and it takes a year. So next July, if nothing changes, the U.S. will withdraw. By then, we also have to have paid any arrears we have to the WHO. And the administration announced some steps the other day that actually global health experts have taken some issue with.
And what would those be? Because we know that millions of dollars will be redirected from the WHO to support the United Nations.
Yeah, exactly. So we owe... For the rest of the remaining amount that we owe is about $62 million for 2020 to the WHO. So the administration said that $62 million, rather than going to the WHO, which the regulations state should happen, it will go to other UN agencies. Some global health law experts have said this is actually illegal, that it needs to go to the WHO itself rather than the UN overall. So, but whatever the case, the U.S. has said it will give its money, the remaining money that it owes to WHO, to the U.N. But the Trump administration said at the same time that about a little more than $100 million will go to the WHO this year for specific programs that the administration can't find other organizations for.
So picking and choosing how it's going to program those dollars. I'm wondering, Betsy, what does our separation or non-involvement in the future with the WHO, what does that mean on the path to a vaccine?
Well, interesting question. I mean, the WHO is coordinating all of these vaccine research efforts and trials around the world. So, it's a year out. It's hard to say what it means, but it does reduce our ability to or our involvement in sharing vaccine expertise and also possibly sharing actual vaccine. There is an effort that was led by the WHO called COVAX to secure vaccine for the rest of the world. Not the rest of the world, but the developing world, countries that can't afford it on its own. We as the U.S. have decided not to participate, but the administration has said they will share that the U.S. will share unused doses with the rest of the world. But this does, you know, raise a lot of concerns about whether people in developing countries will be able to get vaccine and therefore be able to be protected. And if you have the virus spreading somewhere in the world, it can spread to other parts of the world pretty easily. It means we can't, you know, reopen the rest of the world and resume global travel as we once knew it, global trade, until we're able to get the virus tamped down, you know, pretty much everywhere.
We're talking with the Wall Street Journal's Betsy McKay about the World Health Organization as the U.S. prepares to withdraw its membership over the coming year. Do you remember when the WHO declared a public health emergency earlier this year? How did you react? What do you think the WHO and the CDC did right in this pandemic? What have they done wrong? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Betsy McKay right here after a news update on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Staying informed is more vital than ever. We've added new programs to the mix on the Ideas Network, and you can find all the details at WPR.org/fall2020. Right now, we're talking about the role of the WHO, the World Health Organization, amid the Trump administration's decision to pull out of the WHO by the middle of next year. In the meantime, the administration says it will withhold payments to the WHO, begin to recall American staff. What do you make of this move? How do you feel about the WHO's efforts to coordinate the international response to COVID? Where were missteps and where was foresight? Join in 800-642-1234. Betsy McKay is our guide. She's a senior writer at the Wall Street Journal, and she stays with us. Let's bring in a call now. Rob is joining us from Radisson this morning. Hi, Rob.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. The way I see it is the emphasis is China let us know about this early in January. The president didn't do anything until the 30th or the 31st of January. My point being, this is human error that occurred. Even if it was unintentional, it was human error. What we need to focus on is the virus now, not who done it. That's plenty of time for that later. We need to focus. But
so Rob, you're saying we shouldn't be pointing fingers now at the WHO or at anyone. We need to solve and fight the virus.
Right.
Betsy, what do you see about the reforms that the Trump administration is asking for? And do you see that the U.S. and the Trump administration has changed course? I mean, Pam from Rhinelander called and wanted to know, where is the mistrust of the WHO coming from in the Trump administration?
Well, you know, there are and have been in the past calls from the U.S. government for and in past administrations for reforms and changes at WHO. And there were some that were made after the West African Ebola epidemic that occurred and took place in 2014 and 2015. So there are, you know, definite needs for change. Better management, moving faster to stop outbreaks, better technology. I mean, some of this are changes that WHO can make on its own. Some of it needs the approval of member states, and it also needs funding to do these. So some are legitimate. The U.S. Also has helped lead an effort this year to get to make a call for an independent panel to be formed, which has happened. An independent panel has been formed to conduct a review of WHO's performance in this pandemic so far, and they are getting their work. They just yesterday announced who all the panel members would be. It's an international panel. It includes a couple from the U.S. and it's led by former president of Liberia and former prime minister of New Zealand. So there have been some, there has been pressure on the WHO for evaluation and for reform, and some of it has some effect. On the other hand, people do raise the concern that why are we asking WHO to reform in the middle of a pandemic when they need to be focused on the pandemic itself?
I want to ask you about the leadership of its director general, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. How has he been as a leader? He was appointed in 2017.
Yeah, he was appointed in 2017. He was he's a former foreign minister of Ethiopia and was actually also Ethiopia's health minister and was very successful health minister. He led some efforts there to improve community health that have been, very well regarded in the global health community. He is a fairly popular leader. I mean, he's very good. He knows and understands diplomacy and knows how to work with heads of state, given his former role. And so some global health experts have been very positive about that he, can elevate discourse and elevate health to heads of state, for example, meeting with China's president. So he has been very consistent during this pandemic and calling for countries to work together. And in January and February and March and calling for countries to prepare, for the spread of this virus.
How has he handled the U.S.'s criticisms and specifically, President Trump's criticisms of the WHO?
So he has, not engaged in rhetoric. In fact, interestingly, in April, when President Trump first brought up these criticisms and said that the U.S. will withdraw from the WHO, he took the high road. He said the U.S. is an important partner. He has stressed that over and over. We want to work with the U.S., but he has agreed to an independent panel. He is trying to take the high road on this one.
We're talking with Betsy McKay, a senior writer at the Wall Street Journal, looking more closely at the work of the World Health Organization. She writes about U.S. and global public health. Your questions, they're welcome, about the WHO and its work, how it functions. We're at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Logan now in Green Bay. Hi there, Logan.
Hi, thank you. Hearing the guests give all the facts about the World Health Organization in combating diseases, I feel that it's a great blunder on the part of the U.S. to withdraw from such an organization. And Trump is looking for a scapegoat for his inadequacies in combating the illness, and he's found one in the World Health Organization. And he is constantly fighting the concept of global village, and it's unfortunate.
Logan, thanks. Betsy, what happens, in November with the election? Joe Biden has said he would support going back into the WHO. Can the U.S. change course that easily?
Yes. In fact, Joe Biden has said that he will keep the U.S. in the WHO. And as far as I understand, that is possible. I mean, we don't technically withdraw until next July. So, anything can change between now and then.
What does power have to do with how WHO functions amid this pandemic and what it's able to do? Because its inability to be able to make very pressing decisions, that has kind of haunted the WHO for a long time.
Yeah. Essentially, the WHO relies on an honor system to stop epidemics. It relies on countries. Countries have agreed to first improve their ability to contain infectious disease epidemics, and more importantly, in the heat of the moment, to report key information, to report the existence of an outbreak and key information that the rest of the world needs to know. And the entire world, or almost the entire world, signed an international treaty in 2005 requiring to do these things. But it's not, the WHO isn't a regulatory agency, so it doesn't have the authority to essentially enforce that treaty, to force information from governments, which again, finance it and elect its leaders. So the WHO can't send a team of experts to a country where there's an outbreak unless the government invites it. I mean, one reason that Dr. Tedros, the director general of the WHO, went to China in January to meet with the president was to secure an agreement from China to let an international team of experts come to China to try to help with collect information and help with the outbreak. So there have been efforts, you know, for years to try to improve this situation and to try to get around, to try to find a way to get countries to disclose information or force countries or compel them to disclose information that has an effect on the rest of the world, or potentially has an effect on the rest of the world. But you know, nobody's right now, the WHO just doesn't have those powers.
Let's bring in Stan now in De Pere. Hi, Stan.
Yeah, good morning. We know the pandemic started in China, and they originally covered it up, and they punished the doctors who tried to publicize the problem. I'm wondering what percentage of the WHO's budget was historically paid by the United States and what percentage was paid by China?
Do you have those type of figures offhand, Betsy?
You know, I don't have them the exact percentages offhand, but I can tell you that the U.S. is the largest donor and China is actually a much, much smaller donor. China is becoming a bigger player in global health, but its aid tends to be bilateral and it's often tied to economic development. So, for example, China has given a lot of money to countries along its, you know, its Belt and Road Initiative. It's given a lot of money for global health projects to, say, countries in Africa, where it is also, you know, has some economic development project underway, you know, construction or mining. So that's, it's a much smaller player financially in the WHO.
The Wall Street Journal's Betsy McKay is our guide to the WHO, the institution that is attempting to coordinate the international response to the pandemic. And then the announcement by the State Department this week that the U.S. will pull out and redirect millions of dollars of dues. What do you think of this move? Should the U.S. pull out of the WHO? What do you want to know about the WHO's history and track record? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Betsy McKay here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation now with Betsy McKay, a senior writer for the Wall Street Journal. The Trump administration said this week it refused to pay more than $60 million in dues to the World Health Organization and will redirect the money toward contributions elsewhere in the UN. And these developments, we're exploring the WHO on a deeper level, and we're looking at the track record in this pandemic. So, Betsy, let's talk about face masks and what the WHO has said as it has consulted experts on the matters of wearing face masks. How did that evolve in the WHO?
So, yeah, the WHO has been under criticism for that, for taking a long time and seeming to switch advice on face masks. And it took more than 4 months for the WHO to finally recommend, you know, widespread use of mask wearing. Part of the reason for this is that they, the organization relies on outside experts to provide advice. And of course, that can be a bit of a slow process. The other issue is the science, you know, kept changing. Initially, even the U.S., the CDC was not advising the public to wear masks. And we changed that in April. So it took the U.S., it took the WHO a little bit longer. And, you know, one of the things the independent panel will probably look at is exactly that. Like, how can you keep up with science faster in a fast moving epidemic?
When you're at the mercy of others' timelines, of outside experts' timelines, I'm wondering, do we have a clear timeline on this investigative outside panel on its guideposts and when it will be producing information?
There is. So yesterday they announced their the entire panel. I believe by November they are supposed to provide a report. So they are, you know, underway and hope to move quickly. I think, you know, initially WHO itself had said, of course, we want an after action report, and we always do after action reports. I think the feeling in the world, I mean, most countries in the world were calling for this independent review was, we need a review now so we can make corrections and changes that need to be made while this pandemic is underway.
There is this theory that the WHO mistakenly thought that wealthy countries were more prepared to fight the pandemic than they actually were. What is behind this?
Yeah, so, and we pointed this out in our story last week. They actually raised this themselves. You know, they said, if we could go back and change one thing, we were very focused on assistance to developing countries, Africa and so forth, you know, which are their traditional kind of base of assistance. But it's the wealthier world that has really had the problems. I'm not sure what they could have done about that. I mean, the WHO is different things to different countries. And to countries like us, it's more of a convener. It coordinates scientific work around the world. Like I said, it leads this effort to pick the flu strains that go into the seasonal flu vaccine. It sets norms and standards. But for developing countries, it almost acts like the health ministry. I mean, it's setting policies, but also in cases like this, it's actually securing ventilators and diagnostic tests and key needed supplies for African countries. And it was very focused on doing that in February and March, which is sort of its traditional role.
And that's a very critical role. And so in spite of all these issues, is the WHO a critical organization in our world?
It's a very critical organization in our world. I mean, I mentioned this international vaccine effort earlier that it's leading, you know, to try to make sure that of all the billions of doses of vaccine that will be manufactured, that a portion of the initial vaccine goes to the developing world so that we don't have pockets of, you know, we don't eliminate it in this country, but have it raging in the developing world, the pandemic raging in the developing world. So there's no other organization that brings countries together to collectively fight a global threat.
And does it have enough money to do so? I mean, are the dues enough?
So, you know, global health experts and others are calling for all kinds of reforms now. And one of the changes that I've seen at least one person call for is a tripling of the dues. The dues are not, what they should be, many believe. And in fact, the WHO often has to do fundraising, you know, be involved in fundraising to fight an epidemic while they're in the middle of the epidemic. You know, this is conference calls and appearances and so forth. And it's a pretty small staff. So, more consistent funding in larger amounts is something that seems to be you know, there's seems to be pretty universal agreement about that. I should point out one of your earlier callers who brought up, you know, how much does China pay versus how much does the U.S. pay? You know, we pay way more and our leaving will leave a big hole in the budget. Obviously, the U.S. stepping out of the WHO allows China to assert more influence, and that means possibly more money from China, but also more influence in the organization.
We're talking with Betsy McKay, who is a senior writer at The Wall Street Journal, where she covers U.S. and global public health. And we're looking more closely at the work and the role of the World Health Organization as the U.S. takes steps to leave the WHO. Betsy, you know, as you talked about earlier with the SARS epidemic, it led to some changes in how the WHO works. Do you foresee any changes to the organization as a result of this panel, as a result of a pandemic that will be with us for quite a while?
Well, I think there will have to be changes. It's hard to know what they will be. I mean, some have called for the WHO to have weapons inspector-like powers. In other words, the ability to unilaterally send a team to a country to collect information or figure out what's going on without the permission of the country. For that to happen, you know, countries would have to agree to that. And if the U.S., you know, the U.S. is among the countries, in fact, one of the loudest voices in the past, that has objected to stuff like this. I mean, this was brought up in 2005 when this treaty was being debated. So, you know, it sounds fine for us to say, well, WHO should just be able to storm into China, southern China, and see what's going on whenever it wants. But how are we going to feel when the WHO says, you know, we don't like what we're seeing in Texas or Arizona or Wisconsin. We're sending a team in. You can't do anything about it, you know. So it's a really complicated issue. But I do think there will be reforms. There will have to be. And after Ebola, after the Ebola epidemic, there were some very positive changes. The WHO reorganized and formed a health emergencies program that brought together different parts of the agency that responded to epidemics. It's a bit of a, it sounds a bit managerial and bureaucratic, mm-hmm. but actually what it did was formed a faster moving unit that doesn't need to, you know, get sign off from many different departments and many different groups before it can act. And it has been a positive change.
In the last few seconds we have together, will Dr. Tedros stay in power through this?
Well, he's in the middle of a term. So, you know, very likely, yes. What the future holds, it's, you know, it's so far in the future, it's hard to know. But he is, you know, he is the leader now, and there haven't been, there is not a strong movement to remove him, and he's been very consistent in what he's been calling for.
Betsy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Betsy McKay is a senior writer at the Wall Street Journal, where she writes about U.S. and global public health. Just ahead, the CDC ban evictions, Facebook plans to ban political ads ahead of the election, and the rhetoric ramps up as November draws even nearer. Join Jen White for the Friday News Roundup. That's next on 1A. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.